This is WJBC This Week.
You know, like, I could have died, you know? Like, yeah, we all could have, but we're good.
I can't believe looking at it now versus what it was this morning.
The services affect not only people with disabilities, but also the senior citizens, the children, homeless, and those living in poverty. The budget can no longer be balanced at their expense.
And if we're going to have any chance of getting a soccer facility completed soon, we need to begin now.
What wasn't necessarily done is what we're trying to do today, and that is come up with the best value for the longest period of time.
Welcome to WJBC This Week, where we look back at the top stories and interviews from the past week. I'm Eric Stock. On this week's program, we'll introduce you to Matthew Donovan, a Bloomington man who went from panhandler to honor student at Heartland Community College. We'll talk to former presidential candidate Gary Hart about his new book and his thoughts on today's politics. We'll visit with one of the developers of the first iPhone and tell you about an effort to save the American Passion Play in Bloomington. Plus, we'll take you back to our Throwback Thursday interview with Stacey Marshall Kern. That and more coming up. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Matthew Donovan didn't take the typical path to college graduation. Born in Florida, brought to Bloomington by his family at age two, he grew up in a divorced family, dropped out of school, and became a panhandler and dumpster diver. But just 2 months ago, he graduated with honors from Heartland Community College and spoke at the school's graduation ceremonies. Donovan talked with WJBC's Dan Swaney this week.
You traveled the country living basically wherever you could, in a park, in a warehouse, by the side of the road, wherever you could. And you went to places like New York City and Baltimore, Austin, Portland, all over the place. And you're just a young man in your early 20s at this point and learning life the hard way. So now you decide you're coming back to Bloomington and you enroll again at Heartland. And that's where your story takes a definite turn for the good. And that's kind of where we left it here just a couple of minutes ago. Why did it take a turn for the good? Because you almost bailed out again the second time, didn't you, before you really got into it?
Yeah, as I was saying, in my first semester, my father died, and I got really depressed, more depressed than I think I've been ever, maybe. And I was going to quit school. Just to kind of manage myself and what was happening. And what ended up happening was I requested and got letters of recommendations from teachers at Heartland College. And after reading those letters of recommendations, I guess I had hope again that I was meant to be a student. Because the words of those teachers were so touching. I was in disbelief and, yeah, truly grateful. And and then things got even better because those letters of recommendation were for a scholarship called the Rising Scholar Scholarship. And keep in mind at this point, I was not eligible for financial aid because I did so badly before. But after getting these letters of recommendation, after my first semester, I got the Rising Scholar Scholarship, and it paid for all of my tuition. And so I was able to go to school again.
And not only just go to school, but you really knuckled down and you decided I'm going to be a student because your grades started to go up like you hadn't seen in years, if ever, maybe?
If ever. No, I never had. I was never a good student. So those letters of recommendations really inspired me and made it seem real, like the work I was doing was real. And when I got the scholarship, I promised to the people on the scholarship committee that I would become an honor student, which I was kind of being courageous in saying that.
There weren't many people putting bets down on that, right, is what you're saying.
Yeah, but I made it happen.
But you did.
Yeah,
yeah.
I made it happen. And I graduated with honors from the English Honor Society, Phi Theta Kappa, and the honors program at Heartland. So
here's a young man who went from living in warehouses and panhandling in the subways of New York City to finding a way and a reason to come back and apply what he had given that you didn't even know you had, I don't think, at the time. Now you're an honor student. You're graduating with honors. You're getting ready to set out to go to college to finish. This is where the story to me just, I see like a split screen of you panhandling in the subways and then to graduating from Heartland. Where are you going to go to college from here?
Dan's kind of setting up the question because we talked before this.
I know.
you've had
opportunities, and you've looked at a lot of colleges
right. That
people are going to say, wow. Go ahead and drop a couple of names
okay,
here.
Okay, so my boss at Heartland in the tutoring department, my former boss, Bumi, told me to apply to Yale because of my story and because of my background and because of my grades. Faye Freeman Smith, who works at Heartland, also is a counselor who has worked with doing some talking circles that I coordinated. She suggested that I apply to MIT. This wasn't my idea really to apply to these schools, but it was other people's ideas, and they kind of went out of their way to suggest this. And then I think I'm just going to do it to kind of quit second guessing myself and to kind of prove to myself that, you know, I'm worthwhile to do this kind of thing.
That was Matthew Donovan with Dan Swaney. Matthew says he's applied to Yale, UCLA, and MIT, and is considering moving to Los Angeles to work for a marketing firm. You can hear the complete interview at WJBC.com. It was nearly 30 years ago that Gary Hart's campaign for president was derailed by a scandal when reporters acted on his dare to prove he was having an affair. Today, the 78-year-old Hart remains active in civic affairs and is the author of a new book, The Republic of Conscience, which describes a growing gap between the founding principles of the U.S. Constitution and our current political landscape. Gary Hart talked with WJBC's Steve Fast this week.
A lot of people nowadays run for Congress by saying they're running against Congress, or more specifically, running against Washington. But more and more, Congress seems like a closed system because of money equaling access the way you just described. The main goal for many politicians now is just to keep themselves in the wheel. Can you talk a little bit about if it's possible for reformers to run for office and maintain office, much less even do anything when they get there?
Well, as you point out, it is a great irony that so many people want to go to Washington after having claimed that it's a terrible, terrible place. If it's such a bad place, why are they trying to get there? And why do so many of them, after they've served a few terms or the rest of their life, stay there? I'm one of the few who served 12 years in the Senate and went back home. And I've never made 10 cents lobbying, and I never will. So I think you're absolutely right. There's such hypocrisy. People running for president, people running for Congress, all saying how rotten Washington is. Well, that's part of the problem. And it costs us confidence in our government. This is what concerns me about all this. And it's obvious if you talk to everyday Americans anywhere in this country. They are frustrated, they are unhappy, they're angry, and yet they keep voting for incumbents. I'm not sure why they do that.
The result of a lot of that is the American public feels that Washington is pretty impotent, that there's sort of a permanent ruling class, that there's no access for people that really want to get something done, and somebody might feel that their individual senator or congressman is railing against the system, but overall that the system doesn't work. So what role does the media play in fanning the flame, for instance, of ideologies that are more in tune with some big lobbying interests that fund money into these campaigns, but not necessarily with the majority of Americans?
Yeah, well, you've touched on several issues, but on the role of the media, I think that there is. I'm talking to you currently from New York, and there's been nothing here in the last 3 or 4 days but Donald Trump. Well, first of all, we're almost a year, two-thirds of a year, away from the primaries, so let's wait a while. And why the saturation coverage of a man who's never going to be president? And why is the media so wrapped up in these polls? Who's at 11%? Who's at 13%? It means nothing. The people of Iowa, the people of New Hampshire, the people all across this country who attend the caucuses and vote in the primaries are going to decide who the nominees are. And we're months ahead of that. So the media ought to just take a deep breath and calm down, report the news, and we'll wait and see what the voters think. But I think your description is absolutely right. The sense is that it is a closed system. No one ever leaves. You go in and into office, then you go out of office. You walk across the street. You become a lobbyist. You talk to the people you used to serve with, and you get paid for it. And that's not this hasn't been going on for 230 years. It's been going on for about 30 years.
When you talk about the media jumping on a story that fuels, I guess, a lot of time on the cable talk shows and talk radio and piques people's interest, like Donald Trump. Now, your political career and your pursuit of the presidency was derailed by a story like that that the media jumped on, and what ties in with what's been termed the politics of personal destruction. What role does that style of politicking play in the trajectory that we've seen in American life in the last 30 years, because those stories catch a lot of heat and they have to do with things that don't have to do with policy necessarily, don't have to do, although the Donald Trump statements are extrapolated from what he was saying about policy. But when it gets personal, when it comes to tearing somebody's character down, when it comes to tearing somebody's personal life down, is that something that is just a product of the media? What's happening there? And it happened to you. What did you see it do to what you wanted to accomplish?
There has been a change. There are now partisan media. There are whole networks devoted to conservatism or liberalism. That's new. You have the kind of the Murdoch press, which focuses on sensationalism and what they call scandal. By the way, let's redefine what is a scandal. A scandal are black churches being burned down in the South. A scandal are elderly people without medicine. The scandal is children without food. Those are scandals. And people in the media ought to be careful about how they use words like that, because if everything becomes a scandal, then nothing is a scandal. So that's point number one. I'm old enough to remember Walter Cronkite and Huntley and Brinkley and people like that. Those were journalists. They covered the news. They didn't peek in people's windows. They weren't looking for sensationalism. They knew everybody in public and private life have complicated lives quite often. And that's not the way you go about it, go about covering the news or selecting your leadership. And I think in the post-Clinton era, there's been some retreat from that, because people in the media suddenly realize that they shouldn't be in the business of deciding who can and cannot run for office. And some of that's tapered down, I think.
Do you think that they make those decisions based upon other factors? We see quite often that even in primary elections, there are special interest groups that pour a lot of money into tearing a candidate down even early.
Oh, I know. That's also part of what's new, is the kind of viciousness that the attack ads and so forth. You know, historians will tell you, people who studied American history, that there's always been an element of that from the days of Jefferson and Adams. The campaign of 1800 was very, very negative, both sides accusing each other of things that weren't true. And it goes up through Andrew Jackson and lots of other situations. We've just got to continue to try to make this country more mature. And frankly, citizens, everyday Americans, are concerned about their jobs, concerned about their children's future. And they may listen to all the negative stuff, but basically what it does is just drive them out of the system. They just get fed up with it.
That was former presidential candidate Gary Hart with our Steve Fast. The American Passion Play, depicting Christ's death and resurrection, has been an annual staple at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts for 93 years, dating back to its days as the Scottish Rite Temple. But 2016 will be the final year for the Passion Play there, unless the group that puts on the performance can raise more money to cover its cost. President Lars LeBounty and trustee Andy Bender talked with WJBC's Susan Saunders this week about efforts to keep the Passion Play alive in Bloomington.
Why are we now looking for money, Lars?
Well, we were eminently successful for many, many, many years, going right up through the 80s, right through the 90s. And in fact, in the year 2000, we sold 10,000 tickets. You can buy any Saturday. And some Sundays you'd see a multitude of buses lined up outside either the Scottish Rite Temple or the BCPA, depending on what you want to call it.
Sure.
Now it's the BCPA, Tina, and we were doing very well. And literally the event that's changed the American Passion Play, at least immediately, was 9/11. 9/11 happened, and in 2001 we sold those 10,000 tickets. 2002... The bus trips that were coming from these states all the way around couldn't sell any tickets. And they'd said it wasn't just the American Passion Play. They just couldn't sell any tickets to anybody to go anywhere that year.
Mm-hmm.
And we went from 10,000 tickets down to 3,000 tickets in 1 year.
Wow.
That is not enough to cover costs.
But from that point on, we stayed at that level of approximately 3,000 tickets?
We did a little bit of increasing. We got up a little bit in 2003, and in 2004 we took another hit when Mel Gibson brought out The Passion of the Christ. Because then a different group of people, our church groups that regularly attended, decided that year they're going to go see the play. The movie. Go see the movie, and some of them didn't come back. And so then we fell back into this 2,500 to 4,000 ticket range. And in that time, we were trying some different marketing techniques. We were trying an assortment of different things on stage and information out to the public. We had videos made. We had a national campaign run with videos across public radio, public TV stations. And we always sold about 3,000 tickets. We lost it. And part of that's coming to the changing demographics. Still, no doubt, the churches are our biggest audience that come to see the play.
But church. Attendance is also down.
Exactly. We're just another extension of their own attendance. And so we've been living off our good life since about 2001, and we're coming to the point where there's no good life left, no reserves left to be able to go on. I got thrust into the presidency last year, I made the board face up to that.
Dollars and cents-wise, how much money does it take to put on the show?
It takes $100,000 to put on the American Passion Play for the cost. That's the cost for a year.
For 1 year.
And we are losing about $30,000 to $50,000 a year, depending on ticket sales.
Now, the good news is I had a frank conversation about this with Tina Salamone on and off the air. She said the Bloomington Center for Performing Arts was made aware of your financial difficulties, and because of their great love of the show and respect for the show, she was overwhelmed in awe of how much she enjoyed it. And she's a picky theater person, you're right?
Yes, she is.
So that's a big compliment to the show. They were able to negotiate a discount.
That's
so
true.
I don't want anyone to hear this and think that the city and the Bloomington Center for Performing Arts isn't trying to assist. But she was also very honest about the fact that we can't do it for free at the BCPA because there are costs, unavoidable costs involved. But that's not the only place money goes. It's not just the rental of the space.
No, that's exactly true. We own two boroughs that are on stage for Jesus to ride in on during the entrance into Jerusalem. They cost us a few dollars a year. We do have one full-time employee, and we have several part-time people that do assorted things. And then we have quite a bit of costume expense. We put out about $15,000 to $20,000 in advertising.
Mm-hmm.
And so when it all adds up at the end of the year, it's about $100,000.
And I'm guessing $15,000 to $20,000 in advertising doesn't go very far anymore.
It does not go very far.
So, okay. I have seen that you have a fundraising campaign going. Andy, we'll look back at you here on WJBC. How can people donate money, and is there an incentive to donating money? Some campaigns do that.
Well, obviously the incentive we have right now is for people to save this historic play and come out and see it and the opportunity to see it again. So we don't really have any sort of incentives other than that right now. The easiest way for people to get a hold of us in an immediate sense, so you can go do this right now, you don't have to wait, is go to our GoFundMe site, which is www.gofundme.com/passionplay. That is absolutely the easiest way to do that. We obviously have all our contact information on our website, which is www.americanpassionplay.org, which has our P.O. Box address on there. And certainly those folks who like to write checks and put those in the mail, we would appreciate that. And I would say that no donation is too small. Every little bit helps. We've gotten a lot of generosity pouring out of the community, and we'd love to see some more because this is something we need to save. It's very valuable to this community.
That was Andy Bender and Lars Labonte with the American Passion Play with Susan Saunders. Today's local news is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Steve Jobs was the face of Apple when the iPhone was launched, but he wasn't the only one providing the brains behind one of the most significant product creations of the 21st century. Andy Grignon was one of the key engineers who worked on the first iPhone. He's featured on the National Geographic Channel show, The 2000s, A New Reality. And Andy Grignon talked with WJBC's Steve Fast this week.
Did you and your team at Apple, or even Steve Jobs, realize you were pretty much going to change the way people live their lives from that point out?
We didn't. I wish I could say we did. But there is, I think Steve probably understood more than he ever let on, right? I think he knew he had a game changer on his hands. I don't think any of us really predicted the extent of the impact. You know, when we first started the phone, his commandment to us was don't allow third-party developer, people who write the software on your phone, to create software aside from us. Because the phone's number one job was to be a phone. That's it, right? Nothing else. And if we let some knucklehead write some software that crashes the phone, then we failed at our number one job. And now you look back, you're like, when was the last time you actually used your phone as a phone, right? It's always for these other things, right? You're standing in line at the grocery store and you're tweeting because you think everybody cares, and they don't. But see, we all use this other, you know, software now that we never ever projected would exist, right? We thought you'd use it as a web browser, phone calls, you know, the basic stuff, YouTube videos, things like that, but never to this extent.
So when you started working on the iPhone project, did you have any experience working with mobile phones before that?
Absolutely not. You know, we were given this directive to never hire anybody in the phone business. It had to come from people who did the Mac OS. And so that's where we all came from. And that thinking, you know, that was, again, another Steve, you know, edict. But the thinking was pretty sound, right? Because there were a couple of instances where we came up with things like visual voicemail, which when you're a Mac person is pretty easy. It's just like a different form of, you know, email, right? That's all voicemail is. Back in the day, voicemail used to be this thing where you had to understand all these cryptic numbers, like 7 meant delete, you know, 4 meant skip, whatever it was, right? And that was kind of the state of the art at the time. And the change, the creating that kind of change was very difficult, not only within AT&T, but in trying to reinvent things. So the idea was if we brought people in from the outside who made phones, we would have that kind of groupthink, like this is just what you do. You can't do visual voicemail because it's really complicated and all this other stuff, right? They just won't do it. We wanted to come in with a different, you know, pair of eyes. And we paid for that because we had the naivete around creating some new stuff, and we didn't really know what we were getting into. So we had to pay dearly in terms of just man hours and, you know, all that stuff. But in the end, it actually worked out, obviously, pretty well.
Well, there was a point where you had to work with a carrier as well. There was that partnership with AT&T. So when you would bring ideas to AT&T and say, hey, listen, this is what we've got here so far, and figure out how to make it work with the carrier, what did they say? No, you can't do that.
Oh, you know how I can't tell you the number of hours I was on the phone with, you know, various carrier people, and you'd be like, come on, guys. Because they all, you know, they care about, again, back in those days, it's very different now. But back in those days, you know, we were carrying around the phone I was carrying back then was a Palm Trio 650. Remember that? It was like the screen, it had like this big screen with like a, you know, it was just all miserable. And that was the phone we didn't want to end up with. But that was the phone that passed every single one of the carrier's tests. It could do this, that, and the other. You could interface it to whatever, you know, random payphone. It didn't matter what it actually was supposed to do. What we were trying to redefine was what should it do? And anytime you try to change the status quo in anything, it doesn't have to be phones. It can be in whatever your organization is. Like, the corporate antibodies kick in to defend the status quo. And when you're trying to invent and do new stuff, that's a very difficult proposition, and I think in any industry, let alone cell phones and all this kind of stuff. At Apple, it was pretty easy, right? Apple just is a culture built on change and new ideas, but those established ones really aren't.
You mentioned that Steve Jobs said your primary mission was to make sure that the iPhone worked as a phone.
Right.
Was there a clear directive of what the product would end up being from when you started to when it actually hit the market?
No. Well, actually, no. I take that back. Yes, we knew Apple doesn't really engage in anything without understanding what the end result is going to be. And so we've got roadmaps, back then we planned out, at least on iPods, we planned out like 18 months plus, in advance. And so we kind of knew what the hardware was going to look like. You don't really know. It's an art, right? You try to define what's going to be high tech 18 months from now, right? And it's aligned because you're not trying to invent, flying cars. You're actually just trying to do something which is going to be perceived as very cool and new. And so that's kind of a tough balance to work out. But Apple has that pretty much nailed to a lot of degree.
Was there a concern towards the end of getting the product together that it was too complicated, that you were asking the iPhone to do too much?
Yeah, actually, there were several points. I can remember about three points around the project where it looked like the whole thing was just a deal breaker. It was gone. And you could always tell kind of where you were, right? Because if you did something stupid or you didn't deliver or whatever, Steve would yell at you. You'd just get a verbal lashing like you get out of Steve. And then when things really go sideways, when the program is really on the rails and you don't know if it's going to succeed or not, he got very pensive and he just kind of sat there. He got quiet because then wasn't the time to start yelling. Then was the time to start figuring out how do we get out of this mess. We had several of those on the phone. And, we got to the point for one where, the chips, we did all custom chips inside of the phone. It wasn't just we bought something from Samsung off the shelf. No, it's Apple. We have to do everything from scratch. And so we had, chips are basically built on software. Like, there's chips, but running them is software. We had the guys that wrote the software for the main chip, the phone chip, and we all had them all in a room because we had a big problem. And that was one of those times where you're kind of looking at this thinking, I don't know if this is going to work. And you've got all these really smart people who wrote the software that makes the chips trying to figure out this problem. And I think that would have felled a lot of other companies. But Apple has a deep enough bench and the power to pull these kinds of people together to make a successful product. It was pretty crazy.
So let's talk about that first public demo for the iPhone. You mentioned that you could sort of see Steve Jobs brewing when something maybe wasn't starting to work. He, of course, was the face of Apple, and he's out there debuting this product to the world, and it wasn't ready.
It wasn't ready in a lot of ways. When we get up in front, so I brought a bottle of scotch to the introduction, and a few of us, we all sat, who were responsible for whatever part of the demo, because there's like three things he was showing off. There's this grand finale where he's ordering lattes and all this other stuff. And I brought this bottle of scotch, and you had, whatever manager responsible had to do a shot after their little part of the demo, which seemed like a great idea when I first pitched it. Like, oh, yeah, let's do that. But I didn't realize that I was actually responsible for every part of it. And so we're going through the demo, and I realized, oh, gosh, I got to, do a shot after every part. And so I'm, now four or five shots in at the end of this thing, and I was a mess. But luckily it all worked.
That was former iPhone engineer Andy Grignon with Steve Fast. Stacy Marshall was one of a few who met their spouse at WJBC, where she was a news reporter in the 1980s. Now Stacy Marshall Kern shares some of her stories with WJBC's Dan Swaney in our WJBC Throwback Thursday interview this week.
Stacy, you were here from 80 to 84. I just missed working with you because I left in early 1980. But talk about your time here at the radio station.
So I remember my first day coming over to the radio station, and I got to meet with then Assistant News Director Alan Sender, and he was covering the Alexander Lumber Company fire. This was quite some time ago.
Right.
But I got a real sense for then of how the heritage of news at WJBC and the seriousness about what was expected. And I remember Steve Vogel, our news director, telling us then, and some of the most important advice I've always remembered is that it takes a long time to build up credibility, and it can be gone in a moment, and it's up to you how that happens. And so that was one of the lessons I took with me as I went on to other careers throughout Bloomington Normal. And currently I am in the enterprise architecture area out at State Farm.
You were talking about working with Steve and Alan when you came to work here. I don't know that there could have been two better mentors, because that's what they were. They weren't like your boss or anything. They were mentors, but they were the best people to work with, weren't they?
Yes, and Alan had, and still has, I thought, although I haven't talked to him lately, a wicked sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very interesting to see the adventures that would happen during the day with him being in the building. Steve was sort of the patriarch of the newsroom and helped, you know, ensure its existence and its success, and how that newsroom was known across the country at that particular time as a great source of news and ideas, and, you know, how we might be able to not only report on what was happening in the community, but how the community changed because of that as well.
Biggest story you ever covered when you were here?
Well, there was really a couple of them. One was the Hendricks case, not the case itself, but the actual morning when the children were discovered.
Tell me that story if you can first, because that's the one that everybody goes to. I'll never forget the morning where I was when that story happened. What was it like?
That's a really hard morning for me. It was very difficult because, you know, when there are children involved, it just takes on a different type of sensitivity. And I was sitting in the back. I remember this, like, distinctly. I was sitting in the back of the newsroom car, and back then they were maroon with light interior. That's how much the details are burned into my head, and really was hearing from Steve the gravity of the situation and knowing that we had to cover that and that we had to basically maintain a sense of calm but be able to tell the story. And the actual telling of that story at that point was taking a look at all of the law enforcement who were coming in and out of the house and how they were really affected at that time by what they saw, and trying to be a good reporter of what the actions were that transpired, but really not knowing much about the full story yet. It was very, very challenging. And then so my days there went from that to one of the first experiences that I had at Evelyn Chapel was hearing one of the professors at Illinois Wesleyan playing the organ. And that day, at that time, and the sound that was created by that, and I play piano and violin and viola for quite some time and am very musical still to this day, but it was such a overwhelmingly impactful to the senses. And that is a very hard story to convey in radio.
Yeah.
Because I had natural sound, but just the impact of what that organ sounded like at that particular time. I know it was a compilation of the music that was played and the reverberation that was in that building and the way that it made sound come alive. And that's just a couple of the things that I remember. You know, every day was different. You never knew what was going to happen when you walked in or what you would be reporting on or necessarily what time you'd get home. Because depending on how late meetings went, everybody else went home from the city council meeting, but we went back to basically be able to write that story and and give a good sense of what happened in the meeting. The other thing I remember is when Art Sechrest was the farm director, he would call in reports at a certain time of day. And that evening, there happened to be a tornado that happened near Farmer City. And so when he called in, I was one of the only people working that night, and I told him he had to call back. And Steve Vogel let me know the next morning that it's perhaps not a good idea to ask the farm director, who gets up at 3:45 in the morning, to call you back at 11:30 at night.
But, you know, of all the people at the station, Art was probably the easiest one to let that slide off because he's such a nice man. And
he was.
Yeah,
he was.
Absolutely.
That was Stacy Marshall Kern with Dan Sweeney at our Throwback Thursday interview. The Week in News is next. This WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. About three dozen homes were damaged Thursday night when a tornado ripped through Delavan in Tazewa County. Delavan resident Drew Selman says immediately after the storms tore through town, he started helping pull people from their damaged homes. He even had to use a chainsaw to get two older women and an elderly man from a house.
They couldn't get out. I mean, you know, we were breaking branches off. I had to fire up the chainsaw to get them out the house, you know. I mean, the other house over there in the corner has got the car smashed into it. The whole roof is on top of the car, the whole roof of the garage.
Some residents in Delavan were concerned the tornado sirens did not go off. Mayor Liz Skinner says they did at first, but the power went out and then the backup generator never came on. She says they'll look into why that happened. Power was restored to the town completely late Friday. Governor Rauner surveyed the area Friday morning. Normal might soon consider a sales tax increase. The town council has decided to pursue the thought of raising the sales tax by as much as 1%. City Manager Mark Peterson says it would be contingent on Bloomington also raising its sales tax. The combined revenue could bring in up to $15.5 million annually, which would be used partially to fund various community needs.
Probably the most important is mental health services, which we've been talking about as a community for 3 or 4 years. The county has, I think, admirably taken the lead in trying to identify those needs through their comprehensive study.
Peterson says as much as $3.5 million per year could go toward mental health care. Other community assets, like a new soccer complex and Connect Transit, could see up to $1 million a year. The council will likely discuss the idea in August. The Bloomington City Council has approved a $1.4 million purchase of a new video and scoreboard system for U.S. Cellular Coliseum. WJBC's Joe Ragusa reports.
The video boards from Daktronics would replace video boards bought from Barco in 2004 for $1.2 million. Phil Charleston, events manager for Central Illinois Arena Management, says Barco stopped producing parts for the Coliseum's current board in 2012.
They gave us the option of buying as many parts as they had on hand. So we did an analysis of what parts we used over the past 3 years and tried to buy, we came before the city and tried to buy and did buy enough parts that we thought would last us about 3 years. We're at that 3-year point and we're essentially out of parts.
The vote approving the new boards was 6-2, with Alderman Kevin Lauer and Scott Black voting against it. Joe Ragusa, WJBC and WJBC.com.
Senator Dick Durbin says he's not ready to throw his full support behind the Iran nuclear deal just yet. Durbin says international pressure on Iran has been working. Economic sanctions have put the squeeze on Tehran. But he tells WJBC's Scott Laughlin he needs to be certain that international inspectors will gain access to Iran's nuclear facilities.
That doesn't do everything. We didn't get our prisoners released. We didn't change the regime in Iran, but it was to stop nuclear weapons. Now, the question that I'm going through carefully now is whether or not the inspection regime can be trusted.
The accord gives Iran relief from those sanctions. Former Congressman Aaron Schock's campaign fund is being used on lawyers, as John Gregory reports.
Schock has spent more than $1 million in the past 3 months on lawyers as a federal grand jury combs over his campaign spending. He wouldn't be able to use his campaign funds for those fees anymore if prosecutors use a tactic from the case of former Governor George Ryan.
If you could prove that there were corrupt activities, in Ryan's case, the fund was being used to pay Secretary of State employees to work illegally on the Ryan gubernatorial campaign.
University of Illinois Springfield political science professor Kent Redfield says for now, Schock can use campaign cash for legal fees since the case relates to his conduct as an elected official.
John Gregory, WJBC and WJBC.com.
And for the first time since the 1980s, Happy Hour is now legal in Illinois, as Alex Stegman tells us.
Businesses can now offer discounted food and drink specials at certain times of the day following the governor's signature. Sam Toya, head of the Illinois Restaurant Association, what can't bars and restaurants do?
We're maintaining prohibition of two-for-one sales of alcohol drinks. We're maintaining prohibition on increasing the volume of alcohol in a drink without proportionally increasing the price. Drinks may not be discounted for more than 4 hours per day and not more than 15 hours per week.
The practice was outlawed due to concerns over excessive drinking. Happy hours can start at 4, but must end before 10, and they have to be advertised at least a week in advance. The law took effect immediately. Alex Degman, WJBC and WJBC.com.
Up next, the week to come. This WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. It's time to take a look ahead at the week to come. Normal's Town Council will be announcing its Harmon Arts Grant Award winners when it meets on Monday night. The Bloomington City Council's Committee of the Whole will also gather on Monday. On Tuesday, local advocates are planning to attend a rally in Springfield in an effort to save the Illinois State Museum, which Governor Rauner has called for closing. The McLean County Board also meets Tuesday. On Wednesday, Illinois would enter the fourth week of a new budget year without a spending plan, and unless an accord can be reached before then. And on Thursday, the McLean County Board will have a public hearing on the proposal to expand its leases with the Public Building Commission to include a new health center in Normal. This has been WJBC This Week. To listen to this week's program again, go to the WJBC.com podcast page. I'm Eric Stock.